Accession number 19656, Reel 5.
Hammond, Reel 5.
So I told him about the feeling of the crow. I suppose a couple of days later I was invited on board the Western Isles, the Admiral's ship, to dine. And while I was there, I was invited to dine on the Western Isles. Admiral Stevenson had a long talk with me, and I think extracted the details of how I thought and how my crew thought and how they were reacting because of the situation that had occurred halfway across the Atlantic. In any case, the captain was relieved, and Treasure Jones replaced him. Treasure Jones was an ex-Cunard officer and had been in the R&R, I think, all his time. We eventually arrived in New York under the command of Treasure Jones, and he was to be the senior officer of the escort for HX250, which was 87 ships and seven escorts, I think it was. In fact, the night before we left New York, he sent for me and said he was feeling ill. He had a temperature of 102, 103, and we had a doctor on board who said he wasn't really fit to leave his cabin or else. And he demanded that he stay on board, and he wasn't to be put ashore, and I was to carry on. I had quite recently been promoted to Lieutenant Commander anyway. With a couple of white pills the doctor gave me, and I don't know what they were, but they kept me awake for about 3 days. I managed to locate the convoy and pick the escort up, and we proceeded. Fortunately, there was no attack developed. We didn't lose a ship. And when we arrived in England, I was given the first command offering from Western Approaches. I think I'd had a very good recommendation from Treasure Jones, I'm not sure, but I think I had. However, went home, had about a week's leave, I think, and I got a telegram telling me to report to where was it? Dundee, yes, Dundee, to take command of the old Flower Class sloop Rosemary. This I did, and Rosemary, an old First War sloop, was my very, very first command. Rosemary then was operating out of Dundee, escorting submarines to a position in the North Sea, where there was a buoyed passage through the minefields for their operations on the Norwegian coast. So there it was. However, that didn't last very long, as we were ordered round to the west coast to be based on Lamlash. So we left Dundee, proceeded north through the Pentland Firth, where we sank a floating mine on the way, and proceeded down to and berthed in Lamlash, where the ship was to be operated with the fleet air arm at Macrahanish, and the Air Force, Royal Air Force, based at Turnberry. This seemed to me a bit of a unimportant job, but it turned out to be quite different. We used to go out, particularly with the Air Force, and take them through every sort of phase of attack, where they dropped lights at first, and then sort of concrete sort of dummies, and finally the real thing, runner torpedoes. And it was all plotting, and mathematically deciding whether they were hits or not, in consultation with the Royal Air Force station at Turnberry. We only had one really bad incident there, where inside port, they were bow fighters, inside port, inside starboard, came in exactly the same height, and one aircraft sheared the wing off the other, and it finished up in the sea in 1,000 bits. But the other aircraft fortunately managed to land, and nobody was killed. But of course, the occupants of the one that ditched, well, all we got was a pair of socks with a foot in it, I think, after all the bits were picked up. Anyway, that continued on and on. But with the fleet air arm, that was another question. They were practicing for battle tactics or sea battle tactics with a new type of bomb called B-bomb. And we were going round to the west, to the other side of the island of Arran, and steaming, and they were attacking in waves and supposedly dropping 2,000 yards ahead. And missing us, of course, because these B-bombs were supposed to submerge, then inflate, and to explode on the keels or bottoms of ships crossing. Well, we had bombs fall ahead, fall starboard, fall port, and even bombs nearly falling, going down the funnel. It was more dangerous than being actually bombed by the enemy at times. Anyway, that went on and on and on, and of course, there were various other things happened. We chased a submarine one night, going full speed ahead in dense weather. We had him on the radar, firing everything at him, but he got away. He was doing faster than we were. We hit up to about 15 knots, but that was it. He got away. And then, of course, the bomb was dropped. And Oh, no, they, no, it wasn't, Corey wasn't dropped then. No, no, the war in Europe petered out. Was over. And I was ordered to take Rosemary to Milford Haven, put her on the mud, and go home. Which I did. Paid her off. Rosemary's war was finished. So I'm home for about 10 days. A telegram arrived. Report to Liverpool, board the SS Orion for passage to the Far East. I mean, this is... anyway. So, down to the railway station. Off again, says the porter at Retford. And I, and anyway, joined the Orion.
This is the cruiser?
No, merchant ship. Merchant ship, Orion. And we sailed for Sydney through the Panama. Mm-hmm. When we arrived at Sydney, I was immediately appointed in command of HMS Lewis, which was a four-stack ex-American destroyer.
L-E-W-I-S?
L-E-W-E-S, Lewis. So I'm in command of the Lewis, and we do various little bits of jobs on the coast of Australia. We tow this, that, and t'other to here and yon, and come back into to Sydney, and while we're there, a ship called the Fernmore comes through.
Fernmore.
Now, she's a merchant ship. She's fitted out for the invasion of Japan. And she's got all the anchors and cables aboard for island hopping with the fleet. Of course, the war is more or less, I mean, the bombs dropped. I mean, the war is practically over. I mean, it's over then, more or less. It is over. The Japs have capitulated. Anyway, the Fernmore is in Sydney. The captain's very ill. Donald's on his Lewis, having the time of his life. Parties and whatnot. And I get a signal. You are to take over command of Fernmore. So, pack me bag. Launch across to Fernmore. Take over command. And eventually sail for Singapore. And Hong Kong. On the way, of course, we have to stop and we stop at Perth for a couple of days. And we have quite a lot of stuff on board Fernmore. I mean, it's a nice ship. It's a cargo ship, and it's a commander's command. Not that I'm in command, I'm only a lieutenant commander then. And 23 officers, mostly naval crew, and
lots of space and whatever. Good food. Well fitted out ship. Bronto Runcimans of in early days. Doxford diesel, 12 knots max. Anyway, in Perth, the first thing ashore is a car, which we were taking for the Admiral in Hong Kong, or for the Navy in Hong Kong. And Perth races are on. And the doctor, nice chap, doctor was, he was a bit of fun. And we go to the races in the Admiral, in the car. And he is in charge of the wine, you know, the mess wine sort of fund, whatever they have. That he had said to me earlier on, he said, don't think we've got much beer, you know. He said, what shall we do about it? Oh, that's all, as much as you like, sort of thing. We were then, of course, I mean, it's so beautiful to be going to sea with the lights on and whatever, you know. I mean, the war is over. So I said, there's a bit of euphoria going on, you know, it's fun. He said, it does, sir. Anyway, we go to the races and we win a bit of money, quite a bit. We were a little black horse we followed through and it won. It won the big race, and I think we won about 30 quid. Or 40, I don't know. It was fine. Anyway, Marine driving the Admiral's car back, we got back. Two bloody great Pantechnicos alongside Fernmore. I said, good night. He said, that's the beer. He said, I ordered a 1,000 dozen quarts. I said, what? We've got to have the money to pay for it. Well, we carried our own accounts, yes. We haven't got the money to pay for it. Anyway, we came to an arrangement where everybody paid their next bloody month's mess bill, and I guaranteed it, whatever. We managed to pay for it. All right. So there we are. Let's see. Instead of ammunition in the ammunition locker, we have 1,000 dozen quarts. Anyway, we rig a canvas swimming pool on the forward hatch, great big, you know, fat. And the purser, dives in, hits his head on the bottom and breaks his neck, but doesn't kill himself. So the doctor said, oh gosh, he said, we must get him in the X-ray. So the nearest place is Christmas Island. So I said, I'll put into Christmas Island. So there's a hospital there. But the hospital wasn't operating because the Japanese had wrecked the place, and there was only half a dozen people there. Well, these poor people came aboard, and the doctor came to me and he said, oh, these poor people, he said, they've got nothing here. They haven't even got any beer. I said, don't tell me. Anyway, that's that. I didn't want to know. Anyway, we get to Singapore. I know he sold the Blimey Admiral 20 dozen, and anyway, we're well off for beer. And eventually, what did they notice there? We had two great big anti-submarine, submarine things to take to Hong Kong, which we did. Anyway, we get to Hong Kong. And we're there quite a while, and Lord Bruce Fraser of Lord Fraser of the North Cape came on board and saw me, greeted me like a long lost sort of brother, promoted me on the spot to commander.
Had you met him before?
No. No. took to, I liked him though, he was a good chap. And said, can send you home, he said. But he said, you've got to do a job, you know, on the way. Take as many people home as you can.
In the Fernmore?
In the Fernmore.
Was it HMS Fernmore?
HMS Fernmore, yeah, oh yes. Oh, yeah, oh yes. HMS Fernmore. And we made, oh, mess decks out of tween decks and goodness knows what. He said, you can make your own route, your own way. He said, all you've got to do is very simple. You've got to drop some anchors and cables off in at Trincomalee, and you've got to stop off at Malta. Anyway, I think I had 400, took 400 time-expired people, half a dozen wrens, a few officers which were in the cabins, and he said, you can make a cruise of it, go away, do what you want. And so we meandered gently down from Hong Kong to Singapore to Trincomalee, where we dropped the anchors and cables off, and across to to Aden. I think we stopped at Aden, yes we did, for oil, and through the canal for the second time in midlife, and met the one of the pilots that took me down. He said there's some good jobs here. He said the looking for pilots. What are you going to do when you get home? I said, I don't know yet. He said, you want to apply. I thought, good idea. And it was then I met the French chef de transit, who was an admiral, French admiral, free French. And of course, when can you join, sort of thing, you know. And that was it.
When did you get a job as a pilot there?
Well, after I got home, I didn't go right away, because there are various sort of things to do. I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, where are we? Suez, yeah. Next stop, Malta. I had to drop a couple of things off there. A couple of anchors and cables. Met the admiral. I hadn't made my number there. And we proceeded to Portsmouth here, where I dropped off quite a lot of the passengers, because I wasn't supposed to. I was supposed to go right up to the north with them, but I sent a signal. They'd allowed me to anchor in the Solent I proceeded from there on in dense fog right up north and to the naval dam port just above
Rosyth,
which was, the ship was really based there. So we more or less destored ship there, and I then took her to back to the Tyne. And delivered to her to Palmer's dockyard right up on opposite Newcastle in Heaven, and paid her off.
Can we go on to your job with the Suez Canal, please? Can we go on to your job with the Suez Canal?
Yeah.
When did it actually start? In 45?
Well, no. No, it didn't.
Do you remember which year it started?
47 for me.
What was it like working for the Suez Canal Company?
Very different. Very different.
Was it a good job? Was it a good job?
Financially, yes. The best job a sailor could ever get, because we were paid a very high salary. We were paid a basic salary. Then we got a preem for every ship we did. So by the end of the month, if you had done 30 ships, you never did 30 ships, say you did 20, and you got maybe, say, 30 quid every ship, you're on a very, very high salary indeed.
Was it in sterling that you were paid?
Yes. Gold, no, we were paid in gold, supposedly. But they were the equivalent rate, you know what I mean. So that's what it worked out. You know, Egyptian pounds.
So what did the job involve? Just escorting ships through the canal?
Not escorting, piloting them through. It involved, in the first place, you join. And you're a Rhodes pilot, which means that you pick ships up at the entrance of the outside port side, and you bring them through and berth them in the harbour. That's your job. When you reach the top of the list of Rhodes pilots, you then go to the canal, where you do 2 months training with somebody else, you know, going both ways, and you do the job, he's just there, that's all, the other one. And if you're, then you have an examination. You ought to know everything about it, every boy and every little bit that exists for 162.250 kilometres. You've got to know it. You've got to know every sort of twerk and the weather and the fog and the dust storms and the whatever. And after that, you're appointed either to Ismailia, where you do that.
Do what?
Well, you either go from Ismailia, which is in the middle, you either go to the Mediterranean, or to the Red Sea. Or you go to Port Said, where you do that just to Ismailia. Or to Suez, where you do that to Ismailia. So half the pilots are in Ismailia, quarter of the pilots are in Port Said, and a quarter in Suez.
Which was it best to be, Port Said or Suez?
Port Said, I liked. I liked Port Said. I stayed Port Said.
Why was that?
I don't know. I like the Mediterranean side better. Had a nice villa there, and, you know, in Port Tewfik, and life was quite good.
Because it was better weather?
Well, a little bit cooler, I suppose, but it suited me. Mind you, I mean, you were not, if you had been told to go to Ismailia or whatever, you had to go. I mean, things went on. Because, when you first go to the canal, you're on limited tonnage. As years go by, your tonnage is raised from, say, 5,000, 7,000, 11,000, 15,000, 17,000 to unlimited. That's how it went. It was a big training procedure anyway, really.
What were the main problems of doing the job?
There was a lot of stress and a lot of hours. You had to be